First, the wounds of the Seven Years' War still ached, and France wanted revenge. Second, if America won independence without the help of European allies, French and Spanish territories in North America might be considered fair game for takeover by the new republic. Finally, any policy that weakened English power abroad was viewed favorably at Versailles. Beginning in 1776, the Spanish trading company Rodrigue Hortales y Company, acting as France's agent, shipped over 30,000 muskets, 200 cannons, 25,000 uniforms, and 1,000,000 pounds of powder to the Patriot Army, accounting for perhaps 90% of the American total powder. Even before official help arrived from Louis's court, numbers of individual Frenchmen had volunteered for service in the Continental Army, many seeking merely to advance mercenary careers abroad. Some came strictly for glory, including the extremely talented Louis Berthier, later to gain fame as Napoleon's chief of staff. More than a few sincerely wished to see America succeed for idealistic reasons, including Lafayette, the young nobleman who, in 1777, presented himself to Washington, who accorded him a nomination for Major General. But the colonies needed far more than laundered money and a handful of adventurers. They needed the French Navy to assist in transporting the Continental Army, giving it the mobility the British enjoyed, and they could benefit from the addition of French troops as well. To that end, the Continental Congress dispatched Silas Deane in early 1776 as its agent to Paris, and several months later Arthur Lee and Benjamin Franklin joined him. Franklin emerged as the premier representative in France, not just because Congress recalled Deane in 1777, but because the droll Franklin was received as a celebrity by the Parisians. Varying his dress from Quaker simplicity to frontier buckskins, the clever Pennsylvanian effortlessly quoted Voltaire or Newton, yet he appealed to common footmen and chambermaids. Most important to the struggle to enlist French aid, however, Franklin adroitly utilized British conciliation proposals to convince France that America might attain independence without her. In February 1778, France signed commercial and political treaties with the Continental Congress, agreeing that neither side would make a separate peace without the other. Spain joined the war in April 1779 as an ally of France for the purpose of regaining Gibraltar, Minorca, Jamaica, and Florida. By 1780, France and Spain had put more than 120 warships into action in the American theater, and, combined with the heroic harassing escapades of John Paul Jones, menaced British shipping lanes, besieged Gibraltar, threatened Jamaica, and captured Mobile and Pensacola. French ships commanded by Admiral Jean-Baptiste d'Estaing even mounted an unsuccessful attack on Newport, Rhode Island, before retreating to the West Indies. British abuses at sea already had alienated Holland, which in 1780 joined Denmark, Sweden, Portugal, and Russia in the League of Armed Neutrality, whose members agreed their ships would fire on approaching British vessels at sea rather than submit to boarding. In an amazing display of diplomatic ineptitude, Britain had managed to unite all the major navies of the world against its quest to blockade a group of colonies that lacked a navy of their own. Not only did that place all of England's supply and transport strategies in America at risk, but it internationalized the war in such a way as to make England seem a bully and a villain. Perhaps most important of all, the aid and support arrived at the very time that Washington's army had dwindled to extremely low levels. Southern invasion, Northern betrayal. Despite the failures at Trenton, Princeton, and Saratoga, the British still fielded five substantial armies in North America. British generals also concluded, however, that their focus on the northern colonies had been misplaced, and that their true base of loyalist support lay in the south. Georgia and the Carolinas contained significant numbers of Tories, allowing the British forces to operate in somewhat friendly territory. In 1778, the Southern Offensive began when the British landed near Savannah. In the meantime, Washington suffered a blow of a personal nature. Benedict Arnold, one of his most capable subordinates and an officer who had been responsible for victories at Ticonderoga, Quebec, and in part Saratoga, chafed under the apparent lack of recognition for his efforts. In 1778-79, he commanded the garrison in Philadelphia, where he married Peggy Shippen, a wealthy Tory who encouraged his spending and speculation. In 1779, a committee charged him with misuse of official funds and ordered Washington to discipline Arnold. Instead, Washington, still loyal to his officer, praised Arnold's military record. Although he received no official reprimand, Arnold had amassed huge personal debts to the point of bankruptcy. Arnold played on Washington's trust to obtain a command at the strategic fort West Point on the Hudson, whereupon he intrigued to turn West Point over to British General Henry Clinton. Arnold used a courier, British Major John Andre, and nearly succeeded in surrendering the fort. Andre, wearing civilian clothes that made him, in technical terms, a spy, stumbled into the hands of patriots who seized the satchel of papers he carried. Arnold managed to escape to England, but Andre was tried and executed for his treason, and later interred as an English national hero at Westminster Abbey. Britain appointed Arnold a brigadier general and gave him command of small forces in Virginia, and he retired to England in 1781, where he ended his life bankrupt and unhappy, his name in America equated with treason. As colonial historian O.H. Chitwood observed, if Arnold could have remained true to his first love for a year longer, his name would probably now have a place next to that of Washington in the list of revolutionary heroes. Events in the South soon required Washington's full attention. The British invasion force at Savannah turned northward in 1779, and the following year two British columns advanced into the Carolinas, embattled constantly by guerrilla fighters Thomas Sumter, Andrew Pickens, and the famed swamp fox Francis Marion. Lord Cornwallis managed to forge ahead, engaging and crushing a Patriot army at Camden, but this only brought the capable Nathaniel Greene to command over the inept Horatio Gates. Upon receiving Washington's order to assume command of the Southern Continental Army, Greene told his wife, "What I have been dreading has come to pass." Greene embraced Washington's view that avoiding defeat was as important as winning battles, becoming a master at what Russell Weigley calls partisan war, conducting a retreat designed to lure Cornwallis deep into the Carolina interior. Cornwallis found his movements checked in October 1780 at King's Mountain when British Major Patrick Ferguson and more than 1,100 Loyalists were killed or captured by fewer than 1,000 Patriot militia. It constituted one of the high points of the American militia and shattered the Tory movement in the South. At Cowpens, January 1781, colonial troops under Daniel Morgan met Sir Banister Tarleton's force of 1,150 men, including the famed 71st Highlanders, near the Broad River, dealing the British a severe and unexpected blow, according to Cornwallis. Nevertheless, the British general was energized by the defeats. The American army under Nathaniel Greene attacked at Guilford Courthouse, and while the Americans retreated, it was Cornwallis who left the Carolinas once and for all. After obtaining reinforcements and supplies, Cornwallis pressed northward after Greene into Virginia, where he expected to join up with larger contingents of British forces coming down from the northern seaboard. Washington then saw his opportunity to mass his forces with Greene's and take on Cornwallis one-on-one. Fielding 5,000 troops, reinforced by another 5,000 French, Washington quickly marched southward from New York, joining with French Admiral Joseph de Grasse in a coordinated strike against Cornwallis in Virginia. By that time, Washington's men had not been paid for months, a situation soon remedied by Robert Morris, the financier of the Revolution. News arrived that the Resolve had docked in Boston with 2 million livres from France, and the coins were hauled to Philadelphia, where the Continental troops received their pay. Alongside the formal, professional-looking French troops, Washington's men looked like a rabble. But having survived the winter camps and evaded the large British armies, they had gained confidence. It was hardly the same force that Washington had led in retreat 2 years earlier. Now, Washington's and Rochambeau's forces arrived in the Chesapeake Bay region, where they met a second French column led by Lafayette. And together, the Franco-American forces outnumbered the British by 7,000 men. Cornwallis, having placed his confidence in the usually reliable Royal Navy, was distressed to learn that de Grasse had defeated a British fleet in early September, depriving the general of reinforcements. It was the only major victory in the history of the French Navy. Although not cut off from escape entirely, Cornwallis, then fortified at Yorktown, depended on rescue by a British fleet that had met its match on Chesapeake Bay. Over the course of 3 weeks, the doomed British army held out against Henry Knox's artillery siege and Washington's encroaching trenches, which brought the Continentals and French steadily closer. As American General George Weedon aptly noted, "We have got Cornwallis in a pudding bag." Ultimately, large British redoubts had to be taken with a direct attack, and Washington ordered nighttime bayonet charges to surprise the defenders. Alexander Hamilton captured one of the redoubts, which fell on the night of October 10, 1781, and the outcome was assured. 9 days later, Cornwallis surrendered. As his men stacked their arms, they muttered or wept or cursed, and the band played "The World Turned Upside Down." Nevertheless, in October of 1781, Britain fielded 4 other armies in North America, but further resistance was futile, especially with the French involved. Washington had proven himself capable not only of commanding troops in the field, but also of controlling a difficult international alliance. The colonists had shown themselves, in large part thanks to Robert Morris, clever enough to shuffle money in order to survive. Tory sentiment in America had not provided the support England hoped, and efforts to keep the rebels isolated from the Dutch and Spanish also had collapsed. As early as 1775, British Adjutant General John Harvey recognized that English armies could not conquer America, and he likened it to driving a hammer into a bin of corn with the probable outcome that the hammer would disappear. Although they controlled Boston, New York, Newport, Philadelphia, and Charleston, the British never subdued the countryside, where 9 out of their 14 well-equipped forces were entirely captured or destroyed. In the 9 Continental victories, British losses totaled more than 20,000 men, not serious by subsequent Napoleonic standards, but decisive compared to the total British commitment in North America of 50,000 troops. But it came at great cost. At least 40,000 American patriots died from all causes, and the number might be as high as 60,000, or at least double that of the British. Although Washington never equaled the great military tacticians of Europe, he specialized in innovative uses of riflemen and skirmishers and skillfully maneuvered large bodies of men in several night operations, then a daunting command challenge. By surviving blow after blow, Washington, and Greene as well, conquered. In 1781, Greene even quipped, "Don't you think that we bear beating very well, and that the more we are beat, the better we grow?" The Treaty of Paris, 1783. In April 1782, John Adams, John Jay, and Benjamin Franklin opened negotiations with British envoy Richard Oswald. Oswald knew Franklin and was sympathetic to American positions. By November, the negotiations were over, but without the French, who still wanted to obtain territorial concessions for themselves and the Spanish. Although the Allies originally agreed to negotiate together, By 1783, French Foreign Minister Vergennes was concerned America might obtain too much Western territory in a settlement and thus become too powerful. America ignored the French, and on November 30, 1782, representatives from England and America signed the Treaty of Paris, ending the War of Independence. The treaty also established the boundaries of the new nation. To the south, Spain held Florida and New Orleans. The western boundary was the Mississippi River, and the northern boundary remained what it had been antebellum under the Quebec Act. Americans had the rights to fish off Newfoundland and in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and vessels from England and America could navigate the Mississippi River freely. France, having played a critical role in the victory, came away from the conflict with only a few islands in the West Indies and a terrific debt, which played no small part in its own revolution in 1789. Spain never recovered Gibraltar, but did acquire the Floridas and continued to lay a claim to the Louisiana Territory until 1802. Compensation for losses by the Tories was a sticking point because technically the individual states and not the Continental Congress had confiscated their properties. Nevertheless, the commissioners ultimately agreed to recommend that Congress encourage the states to recompense loyalists for their losses. In sum, what Washington gained on the field, Jay and Franklin more than held at the peace table. One final ugly issue raised its head in the negotiations. American negotiators insisted that the treaty provide for compensation to the owners of slaves who had fled behind British lines. It again raised the specter, shunted away at the Continental Congress's debate over the Declaration, that the rights of Englishmen, or in this case, of Americans, still included the right to own slaves. It was a dark footnote to an otherwise impressive diplomatic victory won by the American emissaries at the peace negotiations. Chapter 4. A Nation of Law, 1776 to 89. Inventing America. Gary Wills aptly described the early revolutionaries' efforts at making new governments as inventing America. Alexander Hamilton's biographer Ron Chernow noted that the revolution had produced an insatiable need for thinkers who could generate ideas and wordsmiths who could lucidly expound them, providing an incalculable tonic for the founding generation. Yet now, having drunk the tonic, who could apply those ideas in a practical construct that would effectively govern the nation? Who could encapsulate such ideas in a way that the freedoms gained in blood would not be lost in ink? Jefferson's declaration literally wiped the slate clean, providing the new nation's leaders with tremendous opportunities to experiment in the creation of the republic. Yet these opportunities were fraught with dangers and uncertainties. The revolutionary Whigs might fail, just as the Roundheads had failed in the English Civil War, and just as the Jacobins in France would soon fail in their own revolution. Liberty, once gained through the bayonet, had to be preserved by the ballot. Instead, these founding brothers succeeded. The story of how they invented America is crucial in understanding the government that has served the United States for more than 200 years, and, more broadly, the growth of republican institutions in Western civilization. John Adams knew the opportunities and perils posed by the separation from England and the formation of a new government, noting that he and his contemporaries had been thrown into existence at a period when the greatest philosophers and lawgivers of antiquity would have wished to live, a period when a coincidence of circumstances has afforded to the 13 colonies an opportunity of beginning government anew from the foundation. Contrary to popular belief, America's federal constitution was not an immediate and inevitable result of the spirit of 1776. Indeed, briefly in March 1783, some question existed about whether an army mutiny over pay might not result either in a military coup or Washington relenting to pressures to take the crown, as one colonel urged him to do. Instead, Washington met with the ringleaders, and while putting on his eyeglasses, shattered their hostility by explaining that he had not only grown gray, but almost blind in service to my country. Their resistance melted, as did the neonatal movement to make him king, though the regal bearing stayed draped over him until the end. As late as 1790, Franklin observed of Washington's walking stick, "If it were a scepter, he would have merited it." More than anyone, Washington knew that he had helped found a republic, and for that reason, if no other, his presence at the Constitutional Convention was important, if not necessary. Washington's actions aside, the story of the drafting and ratification of the federal Constitution was not one of chaos and patriots to the rescue, with wise Federalists saving the nation from anarchy and disarray under the Articles of Confederation. Rather, a complex story emerges, one that contained the origins of political parties in the United States and the adoption of the legal basis of republican government. Timeline: 1776, Declaration of Independence, states adopt new constitutions. 1777, Articles of Confederation, Congress adopts but states do not finish ratifying until 1781. Articles of Confederation ratified. Congress establishes Bank of North America. 1783, Treaty of Paris, Newburgh Conspiracy. 1784, Ordinance of 1784. 1785, Land Ordinance of 1785. 1786, J. Gardoki Treaty rejected. Virginia Religious Freedom Act, Shays Rebellion, Indian Ordinance of 1786, Annapolis Convention. 1787, Constitutional Convention, Northwest Ordinance, the Federalist Papers. 1788, Constitution ratified by all states except Rhode Island and North Carolina. 1789, New Government Forms. Highways and Wolves. Having declared the American colonies independent of Great Britain, the Patriot Whigs immediately set about the task of creating new governments as sovereign states. The challenge was huge, and the possibilities were unprecedented, and one sentiment seemed unanimous: no kings. Americans, Jefferson observed, shed monarchy like an old suit of clothes. Indeed, this was long in the making, but not an easy transition. Thomas Paine was one of the first to introduce a Hebraic strand of English republicanism that positioned the revolutionary anti-monarchical movement as emanating from Hebrew prophets who represented a balance of power to the kings, who themselves were not divine, much less God himself. But what kind of government would the Whigs create? No nation in existence at the time had elected leaders. There were no precedents. On the other hand, Americans had considerable experience governing themselves, and they possessed a vast arsenal of ideas about the proper forms and nature of government. Governing a nation, however, was different. Adams worried that the lawgivers of antiquity legislated for single cities, but who can legislate for 20 or 50 states, each of which is greater than Greece or Rome at those times? His concerns, while not inconsequential, ignored the reality that the lawgivers of antiquity did not have a shared understanding of Enlightenment precepts, a rich tapestry interwoven with the beliefs of radical English Whigs. Adams also missed a fundamental demographic fact of the infant United States, namely, that it was young. By 1790, half the nation's population of 4 million was under 16 years of age, meaning a homogeneous revolutionary generation started with the same Whig Enlightenment principles and, to some degree, matured in their thinking along similar lines. Probably the most important value they shared was a commitment to the principle that constitutions should take the form of succinct written documents. They rejected the ethereal English constitution with its diffuse precedent-based rulings, unwritten common law bases, and patchwork of historic charters spanning 500 years of English history. About constitutions, Americans insisted on getting it down on paper, a trait that would characterize virtually all of their legal processes, even to a fault. Second, the designers of the post-revolutionary governments were localists and provincials. They wanted governments small and close to home. Just as they opposed royal rule from a distance of 1,500 miles, so too they distrusted suggestions to form a centralized North American state. Aside from fighting the British, they had few needs from a grand governmental establishment, perhaps commercial treaties and common weights and measures, but even those came under scrutiny. One Briton sarcastically wrote that Americans were primarily concerned with the regulation of highways and the destruction of wolves. In 18th-century terms, these Whigs espoused egalitarianism and democracy, the struggling gods of monarchy, divine right, absolutism, and the rest of the feudal golems were utterly rejected. But one should take care to temper terms like democracy and republicanism in the understanding of the day. American revolutionaries did not envision citizenship for Indians, women, and blacks, even in their most radical egalitarian fantasies. Yet despite their narrow definition of polity, these transplanted Englishmen lived in what was undoubtedly the most radically democratic society on the face of the earth. Land was abundant and cheap, and because they tied the right to vote to property ownership, more Americans became voters every year, and with the age demographic noted earlier, a mass of politically active men obtained the franchise at nearly the same time. It is difficult to quantify data in the period before the first federal census, but most historians agree that 50 to 75% of the white, male revolutionary population obtained the right to vote, leading Tory Governor Thomas Hutchinson to write disparagingly that in America the franchise was granted to anything with the appearance of a man. All did not share such a low view of the yeoman, though. Especially Jefferson, who thought that if a farmer and a professor were confronted with the same problem, the former will decide it often better than the latter because he had not been led astray by artificial rules. Surprisingly to some, Adams initially agreed. The mob, the herd, and the rabble, as the great always delight to call them, were as entitled to political rights as nobles or kings. The best judges, as editorialist Cato called the public. Implicit in the emerging vision of government was the separation of power doctrine borrowed from Montesquieu, the division of authority between executive, judicial, and legislative branches of government. This did not equate with a belief in the balance of powers, which became more popular after the Revolutionary War, especially among the Federalists. Rather, most American Whigs argued that governmental branches should indeed be separate, but that one, the legislative, should retain most power. Given the colonists' recent experience with King George and his royal governors, such a view is easy to understand. The legislature's power of the purse entitled it, they held, to a paramount position in the government. Whig political thinkers of the day also adopted what we today call civil libertarianism, or the organized articulation of the Whig fear of abusive power and the people's need to sustain a militia and to keep and bear firearms. Due process, a term derived from the Whigs' advocacy of jury trial, the right to file petitions of habeas corpus, opposition to cruel and unusual punishment, all flowed from this concern for government's capacity for abuse. Other libertarian beliefs revolved around freedom of speech, petition, assembly, and religion, and freedom of the press. Except for religious practice, all of these freedoms dealt explicitly with political issues. Free speech meant the right to address publicly the shortcomings of government, the right to assembly related to groups massing to demonstrate against the state, and so on. By the 21st century, legislators would become so concerned about the impact of money in financing political advertisements that they would attempt to regulate it. But the founders' intentions were clear. The right to speak out against government, including financing of pamphlets, broadsides, or other forms of advertising, was the single most important right they addressed, aside from possession of firearms. Other widely held beliefs included Locke's declaration of a right to attain and keep property, which Americans radicalized even further by insisting on minimal taxation. All of it, of course, had to be written down. Those who invented America did not forget their recent difficulties communicating with Parliament and George III, a point that led them to require that legislators directly represent their constituents. This translated into smaller legislative districts, short terms, and close contact with the constituents. It also meant, however, that since legislatures would have the most power, the Whig constitution makers would bridle them even more through frequent, annual elections, recall, and impeachment. Concerns about character, when legislators and their constituents knew each other personally and met frequently, could be addressed firsthand. Thus, the revolutionary Whigs came to the task of creating a government with an array of strong principles grounded in localism, egalitarianism, and libertarianism, expressed through written constitutions and constrained by separation of power, legislative dominance, and direct representation. Constraint, constraint, constraint. That was the overriding obsession of the founders. Whigs recognized that while government was necessary to protect life, liberty, and property, the people who comprised the government inevitably tried to accumulate and abuse power unless properly checked by fundamental law. Sam Adams assessed it when he wrote, "Jealousy is the best security of public liberty." Such priorities also underscored another important point. Namely, that American political theorists rejected the underlying assumptions of both Hobbes and Locke that government was artificial. Jefferson said so himself in the Declaration, insisting that even when people abolished a tyrannical government, they had to replace it with a just and benign one. At its very origins, therefore, the American idea took a different shape from similar concepts in England and Europe, and therefore at an early point became exceptional in its character. In part, the direction of the young republic took the turns that it did precisely because the hands at the tiller were those of revolutionary liberals who shared the basic Whig assumptions, and their dominance in turn had in part arisen from the departure of more conservative, pro-monarchy voices that found remaining in the new nation untenable. The flight of the Loyalists to Canada and England played no small role in guaranteeing one type of consensus at the deliberating bodies that produced the subsequent state and federal constitutions. Chaos and Patriots to the Rescue? The standard fare for most 20th century high school and college texts expressed the view that the Articles of Confederation period constituted a critical period during which America experienced a precarious brush with anarchy. Indeed, problems plagued the young nation. The economy plummeted, and crowds rioted, with Shays' Rebellion, 1786, epitomizing the new nation's problems stemming from the Articles. This pre-constitution that governed the nation from 1783 to 87 proved ill-suited to organizing the country, leaving the Confederation Congress corrupt, bankrupt, and inept, a body that bungled domestic affairs and drifted into weakness against foreign powers. Then, according to this story, a band of heroes galloped to the rescue. Washington, Hamilton, Jay, Franklin, and others called the 1787 Philadelphia Convention and wrote the Constitution, lifting the endangered nation out of its morass and providing a sensible governing framework. These founders saved America from ruin and established a system of government that endured to the present day. Unfortunately, little of this interpretation is accurate. Historian Merrill Jensen especially spent much of his career debunking what he called the myth of the Confederation era. Like all good stories, the chaos and patriots to the rescue interpretation contains several elements of truth. Certainly, Confederation governmental institutions did not provide all the answers to the new nation's most pressing problems. And some of the story, no doubt, was driven by the partisan political viewpoint of the early historians, who tended to glorify the role of the founders. The 1780s, in fact, witnessed a division of the early Whigs into factions that strongly disagreed over the course that the new nation should follow. Nationalists, later called Federalists, cried anarchy, while others, later known as Anti-Federalists or Jeffersonian Republicans, pointed to the successes of the Confederation government and noted that, among its other accomplishments, it had waged a war against and defeated Great Britain, the greatest military power on earth. So which historical view is correct? Although historians continue to debate the successes of the Articles of Confederation, matters become clearer if it is approached as the document it was, the First Constitution. Even dating the Articles, though, is difficult. Although not legally adopted until 1781, Congress in fact functioned within the framework of the Articles from the time of its drafting in 1777. To make matters more complex, the First and Second Continental Congresses of 1774 to 76 operated under a system exactly like the one proposed in 1777. Therefore, realistically, the United States was governed under the Articles of Confederation from the time of the Declaration of Independence until Washington was inaugurated as the first President of the United States under the Federal Constitution in March 1789. While the Continental Congress developed a structure for running the colony's affairs during the early part of the Revolution, it remained informal until 3 weeks prior to the Declaration of Independence, at which time the states sought to formalize the arrangements through a government that would fight the war while simultaneously leaving to the individual states most of their powers and prerogatives. On June 12, 1776, Congress appointed a committee with one representative from each state to draft such a constitution. Headed by the Pennsylvania farmer, John Dickinson, the committee 1 month later presented a draft of the Articles of Confederation, given its name by another committee member, Benjamin Franklin. Objections to the new plan surfaced quickly and immediately drifted into territory that many delegates had avoided. The issue of slavery. The heavily populated areas protested the fact that each state had an equal vote in the Congress, akin to today's United States Senate. But the more lightly populated southern colonies had different concerns involving the counting of slaves for representation in a body determined by population, such as today's House of Representatives. Perhaps more important at the time, however, the states disagreed over what is often referred to as public domain. Several of the 13 states possessed sea-to-sea charters and claimed lands within the parallels stretching from the Atlantic to the Pacific Oceans. These landed states, Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, and others, were opposed by landless states, Maryland, Delaware, and New Jersey, which insisted that the landed states relinquish all their claims west of the Appalachian Crest to the Confederation as a whole. Ultimately, the parties agreed to postpone the discussion until the ratification of the Articles of Confederation in 1781, but it raised the question of charters and grants in a broad sense. Was a charter from the king an inviolable contract? If so, did England's grip on the colonies remain even after independence? If not, were all pre-independence contracts null and void? And if such contracts were void, what did that say about property rights, that they only existed after the new nation was born? Congress, meanwhile, continued to operate under the terms of the unratified articles throughout the 1776 to 78 period, becoming one of the most successful revolutionary legislatures in the history of Western civilization. In retrospect, the Articles created a remarkably weak central government precisely because that was what the radical Whigs wanted. Not surprisingly, the Whigs who had battled royal governors and a king for 7 years did not leap to place power in a new chief executive in 1777, and the same logic applied to the courts, which Whigs assumed functioned best at the state, not national level. There was provision in the Articles for congressional litigation of interstate disputes, but it proved ineffective. That left only the legislative branch of government at the national level, which was exactly how the Whigs wanted it. Their definition of federalism differed significantly from the one taught in a modern political science class. Federalism meant a system of parallel governments, state, local, and national, each with its specified powers, but sovereignty ultimately rested in the states, and by implication, the people themselves. Whigs saw this as completely different from nationalism, which divided power among the same three levels, state, local, and national, but with the national government retaining the ultimate authority. This latter model appeared after the Federal Constitution of 1787, but a decade earlier, anyone who called himself a Federalist embraced the decentralized Confederation model, not that of a sovereign centralized state. In this way, the Articles preceded, or more appropriately, instigated a raucous debate over the federalism of the American Revolution. After independence, delegates to the Congress changed the name of that body from Continental Congress to Confederation Congress. The number of delegates each state sent had varied throughout the war, from 2 to 7 per state, although each state retained one vote, cast according to a majority of its congressmen. This aspect of the Confederation seemed to lend credibility to the argument that the nation was merely an affiliation of states, not a unified American people. But other sections appeared to operate on different assumptions. A 7-state majority could pass most laws, but only a 9-state vote could declare war and ratify treaties, clauses that challenged the contention that the states were sovereign. After all, if states were sovereign, how could even a vote of 12 of them, let alone 9, commit all to a war? Interestingly, Thomas Jefferson, in commentaries leading up to the Land Ordinance of 1785, called for cultivating the idea of our being one nation, and to multiply the instances in which the people shall look up to Congress as their head. The schizophrenic nature of some of these provisions came to a head in the Amendment Clause, where 13 votes, unanimous agreement, were needed to amend the Articles themselves. Given the nature of revolutionary state politics, this stipulation rendered certain provisions of the Articles, for all intents and purposes, invulnerable to the amendment process. Congressmen wrote all the national laws, then executed them through a series of congressional committees, including foreign affairs, war, finance, post office, and so on. Congress possessed limited fundamental powers. Only Congress could conduct diplomacy, make treaties, and declare war. It could coin and borrow money, deliver mail through a national post office, and set a uniform standard of weights and measures. As part of its diplomatic charge, Congress dealt with the Indian tribes, negotiated treaties with them, and created a national Indian policy. And when a national domain came into being in 1781, Congress had exclusive charge to legislate policies for land sales and territorial government, as it turned out one of its most important powers. These powers put Congress on a sound footing, but in true Whig fashion, the Articles of Confederation saved many important prerogatives for the states and the people. For example, Congress could only requisition money and soldiers from the states, thus leaving true taxation and military power at the local level. This taxation provision meant that Congress could not regulate commerce through import and export duties. So the Confederation Congress was a true Whig government, which had its economic and military arm tied behind its back. As Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation stated clearly, and the 10th Amendment to the Constitution would later reiterate, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Confederation delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. The New State Constitutions. Meanwhile, the states had simultaneously developed their own constitutions, with all states except Connecticut and Rhode Island replacing their original colonial constitutions. In these documents, the states held sovereignty over the National Congress in many matters. During the years immediately following the Declaration of Independence, 11 of the 13 states drafted and ratified new constitutions. In nearly all cases, radicals squared off against moderates, with the radicals carrying the day. State constitution-making is a complex subject, with variations spanning the 13 new American states. Yet certain patterns emerged. All of the constitution-makers acknowledged the almost sacred nature of writing constitutions, and sharply differentiated that process from that of merely passing legislation. Moreover, most of the new constitutions showed marked radical Whig tendencies, including written bills of rights and institutionalized broad suffrage for white males. They fostered republicanism through direct representation and provided for separation of power between executive, legislative, and judicial branches, but not balance of power. Indeed, the 13 state governments, with notable exceptions, severely limited the executive and judicial branches of government. The result was that there were smaller state versions of the national model, strong legislative government with important but less powerful judicial and executive components. Once again, the drafters all accepted the premise that their constitutions should appear in concise written form. They also agreed that a crucial difference between constitutional law and mere statute law existed. Constitutional law stood as close to natural law, God's law, as mere mortals could possibly place it. In this, the drafters inherently sided with classical thinkers like Aristotle over modernists like Thomas Hobbes. The former all held that government was natural, even to the point of being a spiritual exercise, whereas the latter held that the state was artificial. Jefferson, one of the most vocal advocates of small government, wrote in the Declaration that after altering or abolishing government, it is the right of the people to institute new government. By siding with the classical thinkers, Americans avoided some of the assumptions that weakened European constitutions, where the artificiality model dominated. Think of post-World War II France, with its 24 governments in 12 years. Consequently, the natural basis of constitutional law made it fundamental law, which positioned it much higher than statute law. Thus, constitutions must, whenever possible, be drafted and ratified by special bodies, constitutional conventions, not merely state legislatures, and ultimately 9 of the 11 new constitutions were drafted and appeared in this manner. The state constitutions emerged during the most radical years of revolutionary political thought, and most of them reflect that radicalism. A point most noticeable in the Constitution's tendencies to hedge and restrain their executives. After 1776, for example, governors could no longer introduce legislation, convene or adjourn assemblies, command state militia, pardon criminals, or veto bills. Pennsylvania axed the governorship from its constitution, allowing the legislature to serve in executive capacity. The judiciary suffered similar checks on its powers. Legislators and voters selected judges to serve set terms in office, or even on the basis of good behavior. Judges' salaries were fixed by the legislatures, which also retained the right to impeach or recall magistrates, and no judge had the prerogative for judicial review or determining constitutionality. Like the executive, the judiciary in most states remained a creature of the legislature. Nearly all of the new constitutions expanded suffrage, republicanism, and the civil liberties of the constituents. 8 constitutions contained bills of rights, delineating the terms of freedom of speech and religion, citizen protections from the military, the right to keep and bear arms, and components of due process. Taxpayers saw their enfranchisement expand to the extent that Rhode Island granted universal white male suffrage. Representation was proportional. State capitals moved westward to better serve growing frontier constituents. Legislators stood for annual election, and voters kept them in check through term limits and recall. 3 states eliminated their upper legislative house, but in all other cases, the lower house retained more power than the upper, controlling each state's economic and military policies, as well as important judicial and executive powers. Pennsylvania and Massachusetts represented 2 opposite extremes of state constitution making. Pennsylvania eliminated the governorship and the upper house of the legislature. "We never shall have a hereditary aristocracy," wrote one Pennsylvania Whig in opposition to a state senate. God and the Americans. Few issues have been more mischaracterized than religion and the government's attitude toward religion in the early republic. Modern Americans readily cite the separation of church and state, a phrase that does not appear in the Constitution, yet is a concept that has become a guiding force in the disestablishment of religion in America. Most settlers had come to America with the quest for religious freedom constituting an important, if not the most important, goal of their journey. Maryland was a Catholic state, Pennsylvania a Quaker state, Massachusetts a Puritan state, and so on. But when Thomas Jefferson penned Virginia's Statute for Religious Freedom, enacted 1786, the state's relationship to religion seemed to change. Or did it? Jefferson wrote the Virginia Sabbath Law, as well as ordinances sanctioning public days of prayer and fasting, and even incorporated some of the Levitical code into the state's marriage laws. In 1784, however, controversy arose over the incorporation of the Protestant Episcopal Church, with Baptists and Presbyterians complaining that the act unfairly bound church and state. The matter, along with some related issues, came before several courts, which by 1804 had led the legislature to refuse petitions for incorporation by churches or other religious bodies. By that time, the American religious experience had developed several characteristics that separated it from any of the European churches. Latitudinarianism, which had continued from colonial times, stressed that church policies were driven from the bottom up. In Protestant congregations, church elders, deacons, and other lay bodies determined dogma more than a central church authority, while Catholics, such as John Carroll, lived in parishes where priests were elected by the laity. And overall, Americans de-emphasized the clergy. Not only did states such as Virginia refuse to fund the salaries of ministers, but the Calvinist Puritan tradition that each man read and interpret the Bible for himself meant that the clergy's authority had already diminished. Second, Americans were at once both evangelically active and liturgically lax. What mattered was salvation and right living, not the form or structure of the religion. Ceremonies and practices differed wildly, even within denominations. And finally, as with America's new government itself, the nation's religion made central the personal salvation experience. All of this had the effect of separating American churches from their European ancestors, but also of fostering sects and divisions within American Christianity itself. Above all, of course, America was a Protestant nation. Only about 2,500 Jews lived in America in 1790, and there was no contemporary record of any Muslims or adherents to other religions. Thus, they were treated not so much with tolerance as with the indifference their numbers warranted. So in the legal context, the debates never included non-Christian groups in the deliberations. At the same time, this generic Christian faith, wherein everyone agreed to disagree, served as a unifying element by breaking down parish boundaries and, in the process, destroying other political and geographic boundaries. The Great Awakening had galvanized American Christianity, pushing it even further into evangelism, and it served as a springboard to the revolution itself, fueling the political fire with religious fervor and imbuing in the founders a sense of rightness of cause. To some extent, then, the essential difference between the American Revolution and the French Revolution is that the American Revolution was a religious event, whereas the French Revolution was an anti-religious event. John Adams said as much when he observed that the revolution was in the mind and hearts of the people, and change in their religious sentiments of their duties and obligations. Consequently, America, while attaching itself to no specific variant of Christianity, operated on an understanding that the nation would adopt an unofficial, generic Christianity that fit hand in glove with republicanism. Alexis de Tocqueville, whose perceptive Democracy in America, 1835, provided a virtual roadmap for the future direction of the young nation, observed that in the United States, the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom were intimately united and that they reigned in common over the same country. Americans, he added, viewed religion as indispensable to the maintenance of the republican institutions because it facilitated free institutions. Certain fundamentals seemed unanimously agreed upon. Posting of the Ten Commandments in public places was appropriate. Prayers in virtually all official and public functions were expected. America was particularly blessed because of her trust in God, and even when individuals in civic life did not abide to a specific faith, they were expected to act like good Christians and conduct themselves as would a believer. Politicians like Washington walked a fine line between maintaining the secularist form and yet supplying the necessary spiritual substance. In part, this explains why so many of the early writings and speeches of the founders were both timeless and uplifting. Their message of spiritual virtue, cloaked in republican processes of civic duty, reflected a sense of providential mission for the young country. With no state boundaries to confine them, religious doctrines found themselves in a competition every bit as sharp as Adam Smith's invisible hand of the market. Most communities put up a church as one of their first civic acts, and traveling preachers traversed the backwoods and frontiers even where no churches existed. Ministers such as Lyman Beecher, 1775 to 1863, characterized this new breed of traveling evangelist. Beecher, a New Haven Presbyterian who later assumed the presidency of the Cincinnati Theological Seminary, gained fame for his essay against dueling after Hamilton's death in 1804. Well before that, however, he pioneered American religious voluntarism. Like other westward-looking Americans, Beecher accepted the notion that the nation's destiny rested in the West, precisely where the frontier spread people out so much that a revival was the only way to reach them. Beecher's revivals took place in settings that enjoyed great popularity among evangelists, the camp meetings. At these gatherings, occasionally in the open air or in a barn, the traveling preachers spread the gospel, occasionally emphasizing the emotional by urging the participants to engage in frenzied shouting, jerking, or falling, presumably under the influence of the Holy Spirit. With each new congregation that the itinerant ministers formed, new doctrines and sects appeared. Regional differences in established churches produced reasoned differences, but also encouraged rampant sectarianism. Each new division weakened the consensus about what constituted accepted doctrines of Christianity, to the point that in popular references, America ceased being a godly nation and became a good nation that could not agree on the specifics of goodness. In education especially, the divisions threatened to undermine the Christian basis of the young country. Other dangerous splits in doctrine developed over the proper relationship with Indians. Eleazar Wheelock, 1711 to 79, for example, a Congregationalist and a key influence in the Awakening movement, founded a school for Indians that became Dartmouth College in 1769. To the extent that Indians were offered education, it had to occur in segregated schools like Wheelock's, though he was not the first religious leader to establish a school. As we have seen, religious groups of all denominations and doctrines accounted for the majority of quality education, especially at the higher levels. Although Scots-Irish Presbyterian ministers were trained in Northern Ireland or Scotland, other denominations' colleges, rather than reinforcing existing orthodoxy, frequently produced heretics, or, at least, liberals who shared few of their founders' doctrinal views. At Harvard University, founded to enforce Puritanism in 1636 by the bequest of Reverend John Harvard, its original motto, Veritas, Christo et Ecclesia, Truth, Christ, and the Church, and its logo of two books facing open and one facing downward to represent the hidden knowledge of God, were ditched when the school slipped into the hands of liberal groups in 1707. The new motto, simply Veritas, and its symbol of all three books facing up, aptly illustrated the dominance of a Unitarian elite that dominated the school, including such notables as John Quincy Adams and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. By focusing on a rationalistic Enlightenment approach to salvation, in which virtually all men were saved, not to mention the presumption that all knowledge could be known, the Unitarians, who denied the Trinity, hence the term Unitarian from unity or one, had opposed the Great Awakening of the 1740s. Henry Ware at Harvard and later William Ellery Channing, whose 1819 sermon, Unitarian Christianity, established the basis for the sect, challenged the Congregational and Puritan precepts from 1805 to 25. At that point, the American Unitarian Association was formed, but much earlier it had exerted such a powerful influence in Boston that in 1785 King's Chapel removed all references to the Trinity in the prayer books. Unitarians were not alone in their unorthodox views. Many sects strained at the limits of what was tolerable even under the broadest definitions of Christianity. Yet they still maintained, for the most part, a consensus on what constituted morality and ethics. Consequently, a subtle yet profound shift occurred in which the religious in America avoided theological issues and instead sought to inculcate a set of moral assumptions under which even Jews and other non-Christians could fit. This appeared in its most visible form in education. Jefferson's concern over state funding of a particular religion centered on the use of tax money for clerical salaries. Eventually, though, the pressure to eliminate any sectarian doctrines from public schools was bound to lead to clashes with state governments over which concepts were denominational and which were generically Christian. Church-state separation also spilled over into debates about the applicability of charters and incorporation laws for churches. Charters always contained elements of favoritism, which was one reason banks were steeped in controversy. But in seeking to avoid granting a charter to any particular church, the state denied religious organizations the same rights accorded hospitals and railroads. Even in Virginia, where separation of church and state began, the reluctance to issue religious charters endowed churches with special characteristics that were not applied to other corporations. Trying to keep religion and politics apart, Virginia lawmakers unintentionally wrapped religion and politics, church and state, ever more closely together. The good news was that anyone who was dissatisfied with a state's religion could move west. That dynamic would later propel the Methodists to Oregon and the Mormons to Utah. Meanwhile, the call of the frontier was irrepressible for reasons entirely unrelated to heaven and completely oriented toward mammon. And every year, more adventurers and traders headed west, beyond the endless mountains. Beyond the Endless Mountains. The end of the American Revolution marked the beginning of a great migration to the west across the Appalachian Mountains. The migrants followed four major routes. Pennsylvania Germans and Scots-Irish moved south down the Great Valley of the Appalachians to settle in western Virginia and North Carolina. The Wilderness Road, blazed by Daniel Boone in 1775, led some of them into Kentucky and the Bluegrass region via the Cumberland Gap. One traveler described this route as the longest, blackest, hardest road in America. Carolinians traversed the mountains by horseback and wagon train until they found the Tennessee River, following its winding route to the Ohio River, then ascending the Cumberland south to the Nashville region. But the most common river route and the most popular route to the west was the Ohio. Migrants made the arduous journey over Forbes Road through the Alleghenies to Pittsburgh. There they built or bought a flatboat, purchased a copy of Zadok Kramer's river guide, The Western Navigator, and launched their crafts and their fortunes into La Belle Rivière. If the weather and navigation depth was good and fortune smiled upon them, the trip from Pittsburgh to Louisville took 7 to 10 days. During the decade following the Revolution, tens of thousands of pioneers moved southwest of the Ohio River. Harrodsburg, Boonesboro, Louisville, and Lexington in Kentucky were joined by the Watauga and Nashville settlements in the northeastern and central portions of what is now the state of Tennessee. Pioneers like Daniel Boone played an irreplaceable role in cutting the trails, establishing relations with Native Americans, or defeating them if it came to a fight, and setting up early forts from which towns and commercial centers could emerge. Daniel Boone, 1734 to 1820, had traveled from Pennsylvania, where his family bucked local Quakers by marrying its daughters outside the Society of Friends, through Virginia, North Carolina, then finally to explore Kentucky. Crossing the famed Cumberland Gap in 1769, Boone's first expedition into the raw frontier resulted in his party's being robbed of all its fur. Boone returned a few years later to establish the settlement that bears his name. When the Revolutionary War reopened hostilities in Kentucky, Boone was captured by Shawnee Indians and remained a prisoner for months, then had to endure a humiliating court-martial for the episode. Nevertheless, few individuals did more to open the early West to British and American settlement than Daniel Boone. Daniel Boone, civilizer or misanthrope? As Revolutionary-era Americans began to move beyond the endless mountains into the frontier of the Ohio and Mississippi valleys, they followed the trails blazed by Daniel Boone. Stories of Daniel Boone's exploits as a hunter, pathfinder, Indian fighter, war hero, and community builder loom large in the myth of the American West. Many of these stories are true. It is interesting to note, however, that the stories of Daniel Boone often portray him in two completely different ways, either as a wild, uncivilized frontiersman, or as a leader of the vanguard aiming to tame and civilize that wild frontier. Was Daniel Boone running away from civilization, or was he bringing it with him? Was he a misanthrope or a civilizer, or both? Born in Pennsylvania in 1734, Daniel Boone became a hunter at 12 years of age, soon staying away from home years at a time on long hunts. He worked his way down the eastern slope of the Appalachians before plunging into the unexplored regions westward. From 1767 to 69, he blazed the Wilderness Trail through the Cumberland Gap to the Kentucky Bluegrass region, where in 1775 he established Boonesboro, an outpost for his family and friends to settle the New West. He was subsequently captured and adopted by Shawnee Indians in 1778, fought Indian and Briton alike in the Revolutionary War, and was elected sheriff in 1782 and later to the legislature of the new state of Kentucky. During this time, Boone also worked as a land company scout and land speculator. Drawn into protracted court battles over disputed land claims, Boone went bankrupt in 1798 and then moved his large family to the uninhabited expanses west of the Mississippi River. He died near St. Charles, Missouri in 1820, having spent an eventful 8 decades on the American frontier. During the course of Daniel Boone's life, stories of his exploits spread far and wide, and he became America's first frontier folk hero. Thousands claimed to know the exact spot where Boone carved on a tree, "Here D. Boone killed, C-I-L-L-apostrophe-D, a bear." Americans have told Boone's stories for more than 200 years, and his legend has appeared in formal artistic works ranging from James Fenimore Cooper's novel The Last of the Mohicans, 1827, and painter George Caleb Bingham's rendering Daniel Boone, 1851, to 20th century movies and television shows, the most famous being Fess Parker's near-decade-long 1960s television role as Boone. It is important to note the symbolic contrasts in the roles Daniel Boone takes on in the various famous stories about him. On the one hand, he is portrayed as a loner and a misanthrope who longs to escape society and live for years utterly alone in the wilderness. On the other hand, there is the Daniel Boone who was a husband and father, founder of Boonesboro, successful politician and real estate developer. This Daniel Boone, another biographer wrote, was an empire builder and philanthropist known for his devotion to social progress. Daniel Boone was, above all else, an archetypal American. He loved the wilderness and the freedom that came with frontier individualism. Like all Americans, he simultaneously believed in progress and the advance of capitalism and republican political institutions. While he may have sometimes wished that America would always remain a sparsely inhabited wilderness, he knew that America could not and should not stand still. North of the Ohio, a slower pace of settlement took place because of strong Indian resistance. Even there, the white presence grew. Marietta, Ohio became the first permanent American settlement in the region, but soon was joined by Chillicothe, Fort Wayne, and Detroit.